All right, well, the projector is warming up. It's nonetheless time to start. Before we dive in, comments, questions, concerns, other things for me? Yes?
If you're going for acceleration in Python, can you use NumPy to make your vectors faster?
Sure. NumPy is installed in the testing server, and it will make a huge difference, you know, like on order of 50-fold, which will still put you at least 6-fold slower than other languages, but, you know. Yeah?
We're using something like C++ or something like that. Can we ask you to use like O2 clients or something like that?
I think I compile it by default with OS. I don't remember. Maybe O2. But you're welcome to drop by and ask me what it is. Yeah. I think I chose not to do O3 because technically it changes some things that you probably won't do, but there's so many of you, who knows. Other questions? All right, so today we're going to start talking about WebGL. And so here I have a random demo. I literally just searched for WebGL demo and saw what I could do. What do we call these patterns on the ground? Caustics, hooray, we've learned something. All right, and this is running real time on my hardware right here while it's also recording a video and so on. Although you'll notice every time I do that, it pegs that meter, so we probably should stop that. Anyway, I wonder if it'll ever get back. Yeah, it's slowly finishing out the frame buffer. All right, so anyway, we're going to talk about WebGL. And along the way, graphics cards and OpenGL and DirectX and Kronos and all those things, right? Because they're all fairly related. We're going to start with why this is more complicated than it sounds. Okay, and to do that, we're going to talk just a tiny bit about GPUs. And I say just a tiny bit because there's so much to know. We could easily fill an entire semester just about GPUs, but we're not going to. We're going to fill part of one day, maybe. So let's try to give some broad overview. First thing to understand about GPUs is they aren't your CPU. Okay? So you have your CPU, you have your RAM, and then you have also your GPU, your graphics processing unit, which usually has its own RAM. Okay, and then of course there's various caches in between because, you know, caches are the lifeblood of the universe. All right, and so we have these devices and they're connected in some way. Now, some of you have an integrated GPU on your CPU card, chip, thing, but they will still act like they're separate because the high-end ones are separated, mostly still, and so they'll act separate. And so a lot of what we have to think about when we're asking the GPU to draw things is, how do we talk to it? And what do we say to it, and what can we make it do, and so on. So this is one piece of what we're going to have to talk about. The other big piece we're going to have to talk about, the GPU. Oh, we should comment. The GPU typically has access to the frame buffer as well. What do we mean by the frame buffer? The frame buffer is a chunk of memory that stores the colors of all the pixels and is attached to your screen. And that's a very weird looking screen. Let's just pretend I meant to make it a portrait screen. Okay? So it is attached to your screen. Theoretically, all of the details of this change quite often, but this is sort of the model we can have. So this is just memory. It's just typically 4 bytes per pixel, sometimes 3, sometimes 2, usually 3 or 4, okay, of just what goes on the screen. And you have this as separate memory in part so that the screen can update it at its refresh rate independent of the GPU's refresh rate. There are other reasons we want it to be separate as well. So when we draw things, we talk to the GPU. And that means we have to tell the GPU what to draw. Thus far, the way we have done that, and you have done it because you've seen things on the screen, is you've written a program that writes an image file that then you open up in an image viewer that runs on the CPU that figures out what the frame buffer should be and then tells the GPU. Usually with like a dozen other intermediaries along the way. Okay, because we typically don't want to be able to control arbitrary pixels on the screen, only the pixels that belong to our program, and so on. So there's lots of extra things your window manager does and your operating system does. This is a much more complicated space than initially appears. It used to be, let's say in up through the mid-90s, that you could put your computer in fairly easily in a mode where there was just an address of memory that was the frame buffer. And then you could write an arbitrary program to write arbitrary bytes into it, and the screen would change. And this is actually quite convenient because you could do all kinds of cool things. Once we explain bytes, you could do graphics, real on the screen, real-time graphics. We've left that land because it also allows you to, for example, go off the end of that array and change arbitrary other memory and so on, right? We have learned to be more careful over time. So there's a lot of hoops to jump through to get this to work. But we also need to understand a little bit about how the GPU works. The GPU is massively parallel. Just as a reminder, the difference between parallel, or probably a reminder, I suppose you could get to this class without having heard this before. The difference between parallel and concurrent. Concurrent is the idea that things might run at the same time, and parallel is they actually do. Okay? And so the GPU, its main claim to fame is its huge parallelism. Typically, well over 1,000 concurrently running processes. Okay? And it gets this massive parallelism way more than you can get in a CPU, in part by restricting what it can do. So it has fewer data types, fewer controls, and so on. But a lot of what it does is SIMD, meaning a single instruction is going to work on multiple data. Hence SIMD. Okay? You could also talk about MIMD, where multiple instructions work on multiple data. That's sort of what your CPU parallelism tends to do. So when you learn about threading and so on, you'll learn about MIMD, where everything could be doing something different. But in a GPU, we typically walk lockstep through the same code, many different copies, each of which has different values to all of its variables, but is running the same instructions. Okay? So, you know, we could think about this at the sort of the assembly level that it's running at, but we can also think about this at the programming level. If you just take any arbitrary code, any given function has arguments. Let's suppose I wanted to run your function 1,000 times. I could go through your function one line at a time for all 1,000 copies, each with their own arguments. This fails. Where will I lose the ability to go lockstep? What programming constructs will destroy lockstepness? Yes. Yes. So this suggests that I dislike if. If is bad. What other conditionals do we have in programs? While. Oh, while we're at, how about for? Horrible, horrible constructs. Generally speaking, each of these that exists cuts the performance in half. Okay? Even if 90% of the 1,000 thread steps are going through lockstep are going to take one branch and only 10% the other, we still have to shut down the half that the 10% that aren't doing it, walk through it with the ones that are, then come back and pick up the ones we dropped and walk through it in the other path. Okay? So the way that the GPU handles these is it will cut the process in half and do it twice. It'll do both branches. And you have something like a loop, if they're like dropping out inconsistently, right? If some of these are going through it 10 times and some 14 times and so on, you may end up almost completely losing the parallelism, right? Every iteration in general could double your runtime as you end up having to run multiple paths through it. So when we're writing our code, we don't like these. But these are the things we use to write programs. And that creates problems, right? So there's going to be various hoops that GPUs are going to jump through to try to move all of the ifs and whiles into other places. And we'll talk a little bit about that here in a moment. But this is one of the core understandings of writing for the GPU. This is true for graphics, it's true for everything else we do on GPUs too. So when you hear somebody say, we made it faster by putting on the GPU, the reason this is something that you didn't just do in an afternoon is because we made it faster by removing all conditionals. And that's a weird thing to do. right? There are lots of tricks about this, which is why we could have a whole semester on this topic without too much trouble about how you program without conditionals. There's special data structures for it. There's special algorithms for it. There's lots of cool things we can do in GPUs that mostly we're going to ignore because we're just going to draw triangles. Okay? And we're actually not even going to do that ourselves. Question?
So is there any way to re-synchronize things after they've been split in part in different parts?
Yeah. So GPU technology evolves quickly. And so yes, there are, and they change. Often they change without you noticing they happen. So often the GPU spends a significant amount of effort trying to find ways, like, we reached a branch, did anybody take the other branch? Okay, we don't have to split. We reached the end of the branch, can I wait for the other people to catch up, right? So we have these various barriers and so on that we expect from parallel programming in slightly different variants. Yes?
Can you explain the splitting part again?
Yeah, all right, let's do an example. Let's say I have, I don't know, how about int min that takes two ints. Okay, now there are better ways of writing this, but let's suppose I were to say if a is less than b, return a, else return b. Okay, here is really simple code. But when I'm running this code, actually let me make it slightly different so that it'll be slightly easier for me to do this example. It would work here as well, but I think it'll be easier if we see it differently. If we say int c up here, and then we say c equals a, else c equals b, return c. This is logically identical, but it'll make it slightly easier for me to illustrate how it's different. All right, if we think about multiple things running at once, the idea of SIMD is we're going to have multiple pieces of data. So maybe I have 2, 3, and I have 7, 11, and I have 21, negative 3, are the three multiple datas I want to run through this. But I want to run a single instruction. So I'm going to try to run all of these data through one line at a time. Okay? So I will just go one line at a time. I will say first, int c. That works. I can create a c in each of these programs. Okay? Single instruction, multiple data. I will say a less than b. That's easy to do. I get a is less than b, a is less than b, a is not less than b. And now what? Now I have to, two of the programs have to say C equals A, and one of them doesn't. Okay, so two of them have to move to the next line, one of them has to jump a line. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to freeze this one, and I'm going to have just these two go. So now I'm going to say C is 2, C is 7. And then I'm going to freeze this and unfreeze this to say C is negative 3. And then I'm going to unfreeze them all to say, so I'm returning 2, I'm returning 7, I'm returning negative 3. Okay? And so this is essentially what your GPU does. It has a few extra bells and whistles. To make this work. But this is the idea. When we hit a branch, we freeze one half, we run the other half until it needs to rejoin, then we freeze the first half, we run the other half. And if I had multiple if statements, I'd have more things freezing. If I had if statements inside of if statements, and so on. Questions? Yeah?
It's like partial parallels. You're like taking sections that of common structure in code and you're just executing.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I keep being SIMD as long as I have a single instruction,
okay.
Right? So I get parallel data as long as I can have single instruction. Yeah?
So it seems like the paradigm people chosen is like the GPU only gets fed one elementary thing from the CPU at once.
Yep.
It can't do an entire function.
No, it'll do the whole function. I will send this whole function to the GPU, and it will run it. I actually send a lot of functions. We basically, what WebGL is a little bit messy. What WebGL does is In HTML, I write JavaScript in which I have a string that is in GLSL that then gets compiled to assembly that I send to the GPU to run. Okay? But in the end, the GPU is running. Right? And so I send almost the entire program, except for the little bit that needs human interaction. The rest of the program is running on the GPU. Yes?
So this makes sense, like, theoretically, but I guess I don't see how, like, why, how is it implemented physically? Like, why is it that we have to keep them in lockstep?
If you think briefly, I won't go into the whole depth here, but if you think about how many of you have taken Comp Arc? Okay, great. So most of you, not all, if you haven't, it's fine. Just ignore this, it won't be on the exam, right? So in Comp Arc, you built a simulator, right? And you think about most of what you wrote was about control. Your simulator is a whole bunch of muxes to say what instruction runs next, where am I fetching, right? And we think about that whole fetch decode, execute is the only place we have parallelism. So we're running one block of whole control that does all of the fetching, does all of the decoding, does all of that, happens only once. And then we say just this little execute piece is essentially running on giant vectors, right? So you say add, I'm not adding one, I'm adding 1,000. But that just is multiplying this tiny little piece, the piece that you could have learned in a couple of weeks of 2330, right? That little piece is getting multiplied many, many, many times inside the chip. The rest of the chip happens only once. So all of the data forwarding, all of the pipelining, all of the out of order execution, all of that we have one copy of. And everything else, so it's just this little piece. So that means we can get a whole lot more parallelism. It's much better behaved. We know what it's doing. It's easier to deal with quantum entanglement and all these other horrible things that mess up small chips, right? Because there's a little controllable parallel part that is duplicated. Yes?
This is kind of another architecture question, but how is the GPU built so that does the parallelization versus like how the CPU is built? Like we went through the pipeline of the CPU right there?
Mm-hmm.
Just like the execution things?
So typically we could, it depends on the GPU, but each of these could be pipelined. Right? So this is sort of separate for that. It's more like the arguments. Like if you think about your registers, instead of your register storing one number, it stores 1,000. And we just do the same work on all 1,000, approximately. Yes?
So a GPU, it has like a bunch of very small cheap processors, right? Yeah.
It has one processor that has a bunch of cheap ALUs.
Okay. And like, what do you do if like one of those breaks?
I guess we probably never really teach you about error correction codes and parity bits and so on. But basically, you can tell if something broke by adding a few extra bits along the way and then just shut that off. And because this has to shut off some branches and not others to do branches anyway, most of that mechanism is available. However, this is really all one chip. So if part of it breaks, it's likely the whole thing broke. And so your GPU will fail at some point. They don't fail very easily. Chips are very robust things these days. They've actually always been one of the more robust parts of processors. It is unusual for your processor to fail. Lots of things will fail, but almost all of them are bigger than processors and attached to it. Right? Wires, right, and so on, will fail much more rapidly than processors. And that remains true of GPUs as well. Other questions? Instantly, if you are interested in dependable computing and how we make sure that no errors happen, there is a part of this that's much more complicated, which is actually alpha particles. So randomly, occasionally, particles exist in the world because things radioactively decay, and they'll bump into your chip and flip a bit. Okay? The chance of this is very small, but the more bits there are, the more the chance grows, right? And so there is some interesting things you can think about here. Yeah?
Is that really only for alpha particles, or really the
only ones that? Not really, but they're usually the ones we talk about because it's easiest to describe why. Explaining why a gamma ray matters is much more complicated. So, all right. So, GPUs. So when we write our code, we want to avoid the ifs. We want to avoid loops. We want to try to make things straight line. But the main thing our graphics processor unit is doing is your homework 1 and 2. That is what you're doing, right? That is the program. Now, if you think about homework two, most of what you were doing was finding the right order to multiply matrices by. And that doesn't require ifs, or very many of them. Right? Mostly, matrix multiplication, fixed size matrices, it's just a bunch of operations. You wrote for loops, but for loops that always ran exactly the same number of times. There wasn't any conditional branches, just a shorthand way of instead of writing 16 lines, you wrote four, right? And so that part works pretty easily. The trick is triangles. To rasterize a triangle, we have to know what direction we're going and what the slope is, and when we stop, there are conditionals sort of built into this. And so, GPUs, actually let's back up to this graph here. All right, GPUs have a series of different pieces in them. Let's sort of walk through how GPUs do graphics. First, some unfortunate historical language. A program that runs on a GPU is called a shader. Because, well, this is history. The first thing we made programmable about GPUs about 4 or 5 years into their existing was we decided we could make the fragment shader, which does shading, programmable. And then that was the thing that you could program. And then we added more on, and we just kept calling them shaders, because that's what people expected. So they're all called shaders, and almost none of them have anything to do with shade. Okay? So this is a picture taken from Kronos, the company that does OpenGL, or the nonprofit group that does OpenGL and Vulkan. This has come from one of their tutorial pages. You can find it fairly easily here. But this is designed sort of what is the pipeline of drawing things. So first thing it says is the vertex index buffer. What do we mean by the vertex index buffer? We mean the parsed version of Homework 2 input file. There are vertices, right? And there are indices. And the indices are connected somehow. So if we were to take your input file and we say, here are all of the vertices, and here are all of the indices for all of the triangles, ta-da, we write those in two arrays, we call them buffers. Those are those things. Okay? That is the geometry that wants to be drawn. That's what we want to draw. And we put that into this first step is called the input assembler. Okay, the input assembler is internal. The green boxes mean you can't change what it does. The yellow boxes are shaders, you can. So built into the hardware is some different ways of taking the information that we sent down here and deciding that it meant triangles. And some of the ways they do this is try and try strip and try fan, the ones we did in homework too, right? There are other ways as well, right? But these are the basic approaches we use, right? So you give us a bunch of vertices, you give us a bunch of indices and a way of understanding them, and internally we turn them all into triangles. And this is going to be built in various ways in hardware so we can handle things a little bit nicer. And then we have a series of programmable pieces. Okay. The first one is called the vertex shader. Again, has nothing to do with shade. The vertex shader takes vertices in and puts vertices out. It does your matrices. Okay? Your matrix multiplication, your model view matrix and so on in homework 2, that was a vertex shader because it moved vertices and was a program. Okay? It is traditional to use matrices for this, and for a long time this was actually fixed functionality and you couldn't change it, but over time we've added more functionality. So now it doesn't have to be a matrix, it could be something funkier. It takes vertices in, moves vertices out, it also can know a little bit of other information. We'll talk about some inputs to all of these here in a moment when we show the more complicated picture. The second step we have here that's programmable is the tessellation step. This is like your Bezier surface, which I don't remember if anybody did. I don't think so. Did anybody do Bezier patches for homework 2? I didn't think so, right? I can give you a small number of polygons, and you can give me a lot of polygons back out. Tessellation, okay? And there's actually different versions of this. So tessellation and geometry have slightly different inputs and outputs, but they're both in this general space. They can generate new points, internal points, they can move points around. We're not going to get into these at all in this class unless somebody says we really, really want to later. So for now, we're just going to say they could exist, and we usually turn them off. Okay. Then there is, notice this is a green box built into the hardware, rasterization. Your graphics card has built in as hardware, as gates and wires, your DDA algorithm. Okay? Or probably some fixed point Bresenham version of it, but something like this. Okay? So it needs to figure out what pixels are covered and what all of the things you're getting to the pixels are. The real world position, all of that stuff that you had in homework 2, it's going to give a whole vector for each fragment as an output of this. And so this is a fixed functionality, right? So coming in, we have vertices, we bump them together and move them. And then poof, we go from vertices to fragments. Then we run a fragment shader. Fragment shader takes one fragment in, puts one color out. It can actually do more things than colors, transparencies, depths, that sort of thing can all come out of this as well. Okay? So the fragment shader for each individual fragment run. So we have a different kind of parallelism up here than down here. Up here we're running parallelism where the data that we're having our SIMD over is the triangles. And down here the data we're having parallelism over is the fragments. And there's this fixed functionality, this rasterized built into hardware in between that removes most of the if statements. We don't generally have a lot of if statements in lighting equations. We don't generally have a lot of if statements in matrices. And the part that did, we put into hardware instead. Okay. And then, again, there is color blending. This does tend to have if statements. Right? Alpha compositing and so on like this, how you add things on top of each other. This tends to have if statements. It also tends to have the other thing that makes parallelism hard, which is it tends to need to take lots of different triangles that all ended up with the same fragment coordinates and combine them. Combining parallel processes is hard in all parallelism. And so for that reason, as well as others, we tend to have this be fixed functionality. So instead of being able to say, given 15 fragments, here's what to do, we typically only get to say, I want this one of your 15 ways of combining fragments. Okay? This may change. More and more of these become programmable as we get better at making graphics cards. And my guess, it's just my guess, predicting the future is a mug's game, but my guess is this is most likely to be the one that will become programmable in the future of this list. And the output is a frame buffer, and we get to see it on the screen. Question?
So you said tessellation was increasing the number of polygons.
Yeah, okay, so difference in tessellation and geometry, both of them are generating geometry that wasn't already there based on the geometry that was.
Okay, but yeah, I didn't think you mentioned what.
So technically what happens here is that the tessellation is going to chop big pieces into small pieces, and then the geometry is going to move those smaller pieces based on where they were in the big piece. But this difference is, it's a little bit complicated. Yeah? No. We test.
We want to make it smaller so we can do it over lots of processes?
Nope. The purpose of this is to make curves. These two together let us make smooth surfaces out of small numbers of points. Right? So remember back in 2D when we talked about Bezier and how we have a few control points, we make a lot of the line segments. This makes a lot of, and this makes them look like the curve. This is an oversimplification. There are other things both of these can do, but that's sort of their main idea. Yes?
Does OpenGL and stuff have a way of specifying the Bezier curves?
Yep. But it's programmable, right?
Okay.
These are programmable. So you can supply a shader that treats your triangles like Bezier curves, or like whatever else you want to treat them as. Now, most of these, let me zoom out a bit. Most of these yellow, you can write this, pieces, used to be green. They used to be fixed functionality. And the rate at which new things become programmable is significant enough that every 2 years when I teach this course again, I have to go check to see if they added some more. Literally, it's probably about every 4 years that a new one pops in. Okay, so it wasn't that long ago when I took a graphics Fragment shaders are well established, and if you had a new graphics card, you could also get a vertex shader. Okay? Now I stand in front of you, was it 12 years later? And now you probably all have all of these, and you might have some cutting edge new graphics card that can let you do one of these things that isn't on this list. Okay? And what will it be 10 years from now when you're doing something with it? I don't know. It'll be at least this. It may be yet more. Or maybe they'll, it's presumably once everything turns yellow, if that ever happens, then we'll stop saying there's a pipeline at all and just say write code. Okay? I would guess, based on how this piece in particular works, that we're at least 15, 20 years from that being the way we'll actually write it. But more and more graphics cards have a separate thing that's called a compute shader. It is just, we run stuff in parallel, anything you want, have fun. And you can use the compute shader to do all of this. Just recently, I believe NVIDIA announced they had a special few little wrappers for their compute shader to make it do real-time ray tracing, with various caveats and so on. Anyway, right? And so how quickly that sort of thing will take over is hard to predict. Yes?
Do graphics cards ever expose like an actual instruction, standardized instruction set, so that instead of like writing like programs at a high level, you can just...
I mean, they have an instruction set, and that is what your CPU sends to the GPU. And if you know what it is, you could send it directly. Okay, but it changes a lot. It is hard to overstate how much less stable this is than the ISA of x86. Okay, x86 only adds say 100 instructions every 5 years, right? Whereas GPU instruction sets might completely change, have nothing in common with the one that was there before every few years. Okay. So yes, you can know exactly what the graphics card is and write that exact assembly. And at some point they'll probably stabilize, but they're still very much in flux. You probably don't want to do that. All right, so this is the basic idea. Now let's talk about, yeah, okay. All right, I feel like we have to say this because people are going to think that you're, you know, at least 5 years old if we don't. Well, 3 years old, because you notice this page is only copyrighted 3 years ago. All right. So we have, let me back up here a little bit and talk about why we have this picture. As we think about this flow, there's a lot of pieces to this, and we need to give information to all of these pieces. And the beginning thing about how you make index buffers and so on, that is annoying to try to make work with everything else. And so there's various wrappers around this. For many years, there were basically two wrappers around this. We had DirectX and we had OpenGL. Where DirectX was proprietary, Microsoft only, and OpenGL was the rest of everybody. Okay? There were a few contenders for these at different times. But then, say, 5-6 years ago, we had big changes. So there was the versions 1 through 11, and then there was version 12 that was dramatically different. And we had versions 1 and 2, and then 3 plus that were dramatically different. And we won't go into all of the details about why this was the case. But basically, as graphics cards became able to do more things and people became more sophisticated in what they wanted them to do, they wanted more control. And so what this wrapper API would look like changed. So while, for example, OpenGL1, you would say, basically, you'd write in code the input form files I gave you. I have point, 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 make those a triangle, point, 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 make those a triangle, point, 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 make those a triangle, okay? And that got annoying when you wanted to do big bulks of things. And so they started adding, oh, let's give us a whole array, and then what's the format of the array, and on and on. And at some point, somebody said, you know what? All of these APIs, they're managing memory and have data structures that are storing information about the scenes, and that is inefficient. I want to be able to manage my own memory, etc. And so just recently, a bunch of different groups got together. Kronos Group is the group that manages OpenGL and what everybody except Windows does. And they got together with all of their people and actually Windows, because more and more Windows applications are using OpenGL as well. And they came up with this other thing called Vulkan. Vulkan is basically OpenGL with the training wheels off. Or if you want to think about it differently, if this is Python, this is C. Okay? It lets you shoot yourself in the foot and doesn't complain, it just has a bloody foot. Okay, so so this is designed to be a comparison between the two. Okay, so let's just sort of go through some of the things, right? OpenGL, complex drivers lead to overhead and cross-vendor unpredictability. This is a slide from their pitch about why they made Vulkan, so it's only going to say bad things about OpenGL, right? What is the good version of saying that? Why would we want a complex driver? It does stuff, right? It wasn't complex because we said, you know what we should do? We should confuse people. No, it's doing things. It's managing memory for you, and so on, right? It says, error management is always active. Oh, how bad. We're wasting energy telling you if you did something wrong. No, turn that off, right? The driver processes a full language, shading language source. You can write source code. No, how dare you write source code? It's so much work to turn source code into something we can run. Compilers, ugh, right? Separate APIs for desktop and mobile markets. This is actually a real point, okay? Because OpenGL and DirectX were big systems, when you had a small device, you didn't want to support all of them. So there's lots of subsets. There's the ES and the mobile and the web and lots of different versions of them. And that was annoying because you couldn't write one application once for everybody, okay? Over here, basically, you just turn all that off. Simpler drivers, they don't do very much for you. Layered architecture so they can be unlocked, unloaded when not needed. We will let you stop halfway through compilation and turn off error messages, right? Runtime only has to ingest this spur view, okay? So this is an intermediate, it's sort of like a compiled Java file, it's a bytecode language. It's a not quite assembly, but definitely not source code kind of thing. There's actually a bunch of these different ones, and anyway, that's messy in its own site. And then there's, because it just takes in like a simplified pseudo-assembly, there's just one. Okay, that will probably change over time as people continue to do things, but right now that's the case, right? So these are the two main ones that are out there, and there's a lot of hype over Vulkan. Just about all of the programs that are written on top of these at some point over the past 3 years have announced, we have now added Vulkan and everything didn't change except these two demos that are 10% faster, right? And this one thing that was 300% faster, wasn't that amazing, right? Because not everything cared about this, but some did. It probably was the right decision, but it also has a lot of downsides. So here's this to say. This same basic conversation can be had about DirectX 11 and previous and 12. It can also be said about some of the proprietary systems that different companies had made before they all sort of merged together. But this is sort of the two different models that we have. Yes?
Is it worth like learning it right now?
Is it worth learning Vulkan?
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you love learning thousands of lines to do three things? Okay. I mean, Vulkan is designed, it takes off all of, so right, what do you have to do? Let's think about what happens if you have to write even OpenGL, the literal level. You have to know everything to tell the GPU so that it knows what to do in every shader and knows how to input the assembly, right? There's a lot of overhead. We're going to see one of the highest level of these and you're going to be upset by the overhead. Okay. Do you want to learn Vulkan? Maybe. Probably not right up front, unless you love tedious coding. Okay. Just like we don't generally start teaching people Fortran. If you really, really care about the last two registers, you can learn Fortran later in your life, right? And I'd say similar things about Vulkan compared to OpenGL. Other opinions may vary, and I may change my tune entirely in 2 years, and it has 5 years instead of 3 years of being on the market, and maybe we'll figure out the right way to use it. Other questions? All right. So, what are we going to talk about? Well, the plan is to talk about WebGL. WebGL is an interface to OpenGL. Why WebGL? Well, I told you could use any language you want. That makes it really hard for me to say, oh, and we'll figure out how you can all run anything else, really. So WebGL runs on a browser, okay? And so we're going to learn enough of this to think about it, and then we'll see how you like it and decide if we're going to learn more. And some semesters we decided to, and some we haven't. So let's start with, I think we have the WebGL minimal example here. Okay, so this is a GitHub page. I'm going to just spend some time, I'm going to explain the code. This is not going to be exciting. I recognize that. Okay, I'm going to try to explain what it's doing. And this, when I say minimal example, I mean it. This is a really, really boring page. Okay, so what do we have? First off, it's written in HTML.
It's my favorite programming language.
It is not a programming language. It's a markup language. That's what the M means. It'd be HTPL if it was a hypertext programming language. All right. So it's a markup language. I realize that you are quite capable of reaching this point in your program and never having seen HTML source before. Okay? How many of you do not feel very comfortable with HTML? If you're a little bit shaky, I want to know. Okay, many of you. All right, so we may, if we decide to dive deeply into this, we may talk about it a little bit. The main thing to know about HTML is it works on really complicated braces. Okay? In programming languages, you have open and closing parentheses and bracket and brace. That wasn't enough. HTML decided, we'll let you make as many opening and closing things as you want by making them out of less than, name greater than. If it doesn't start with a slash, it's an open. If it does, it's a close. Okay? And they have to be matched braces, except they're complicated braces. Oh, naming them wasn't enough. When you open them, you can give them an arbitrary map of other key value pairs. Ta-da! HTML. Okay. Mostly it's trying to describe the thing inside the braces. So as we go along, we say, this first thing just says this is HTML5. Why does it not have the letter 5? Well, anyway. Okay. This is the beginning of HTML. It's written in English. This is the header, so we don't show any of this. The title is that. Okay, great. It's written in UTF-8 because, yeah. And then HTML every once in a while lets you have opening braces without closing braces. No! So that meta isn't opening, it's just an opening-like thing that never closes. Sorry. I've been writing HTML a lot for many, many years, and it still bothers me every time I see one of those. But anyway, all right. Then we have a script. A script tag is basically just a way of saying, here's some text. And we say, I'm going to call the text shader VS, and it is going to be an X shader X vertex. The type here, if a type starts with X, it means nobody actually knows what this means, but I've decided to tell you anyway. This is a gross oversimplification. MIME types are complicated, but that's basically what it means. And then we just have some text, okay? And this text is written in a language called GLSL, the Graphics Library Shading Language, which shading, not because it's shading, but because shaders are what we call programs that run on the graphics card, right? So this is, it just says I have this thing, attribute. All right, we're gonna have to talk about attribute. Okay. Let's just briefly think about this picture. All right. When we think about our vertex shader, let me zoom in here. Coming in from the top of the vertex shader are the vertices. But we also typically have the matrices. Okay? So we have some things that are being fed in that are different for everything that comes, and some things that are not changing. Okay? And then we're going to skip geometry and tessellation a bit, and we think about the fragment shader. We have some things that were interpolated, and we can also have some things that just came in, and we're actually also allowed to have some things that came down from here. So we have some stuff that's about what triangle am I on, I have some stuff that I interpolated to this point, and I have some stuff that just is global. And there are names for all of these in GLSL, the GL shading language. So one of them is attribute. An attribute is this one. It's the one that is about this thing. So this is a vertex shader. It needs to move one vertex to another vertex. So we're saying there is an attribute that is the vertex position. And then because C was popular, we pretend we have a main function. And we don't return anything. We instead set another value. Okay? This value we set is the thing that comes out of the vertex shader and goes down here. These are called a varying. Okay? Because they vary across the surface of the triangle. There was some effort at making sense here. I don't know if it worked. Okay? Now we don't have to say this is a varying because everybody knows if it starts GL underscore, it's one of the globally named ones that must exist. This one didn't have to exist. We'll show later where it came from. But this one had to exist, and so we just set it. And then what are we doing here? We're taking the position, and we're literally just adding a 1.0 at the end. So you have these very nice library for dealing with vectors and matrices. If you put a 3 vector and a float into a 4 vector, you get a 4 vector that had these 3 things and then that. Anyway, there's some very nice things about small vectors and matrices here. Okay? So that's all it's doing, just adding a W equals 1. That's the whole thing this is doing. Then we have another one. This is a fragment shader. Okay? Now the fragment shader begins by saying, I don't need all of the precision you could give me, but I don't need no precision at all. Use medium precision floating point numbers. This matters a huge amount. It's hard to overstate the importance of this line. If this was a high precision float, then we would be able to have extremely detailed depth buffers. But it'd be a lot slower. Okay, so these lines, anyway, single line has huge differences in both speed and vision. And then what do we say? We say all pixels everywhere have 0.5 red, 1 green, 1 blue, and are fully opaque. So every pixel everywhere is this sort of, what is that? That's a magenta, right? A pale magenta. Pinkish. Why? Sorry, that isn't magenta. That's a cyan. That's sorry, a pale cyan, like a sky blue. Why? Because we wanted a minimal example. Okay? If you want any more lines, yeah, this is the minimum number of lines I needed. Okay? So, yes. Then we have decided this actually is technically not minimal, but WebGL doesn't tell us what's going wrong, so this is something to actually give us some sort of error message if something crashes. And we may or may not look at that later. Then we have JavaScript. All right, JavaScript. I just realized I was about to say something that's going to be recorded. All right, JavaScript is one of the most popular languages in the world. For weird reasons. JavaScript was basically written by one guy who thought maybe it'd be cool if our websites could do more than just draw text. I like Lisp, but my coworkers like C. And Java's really popular right now. We'll call it Java. We'll make it look like C and behave like Lisp. Okay? And then it took over the world to an unbelievable degree. And so many different editions have added, and they've always tried to add things in a pseudo-backwards compatible way, and then different companies have made their own versions and said they're compatible, but they're not. Anyway, it's a complicated language. But the core of it looks sort of like a Python-ish kind of thing. It's dynamically typed, but we do get to declare variables in advance, because not because it's important to declare them in advance, but because if we don't declare them, then they end up belonging to the wrong object. Because all variables belong to an object. It just might be the window, and it might be the document, and it might be some other object. Anyway, so it's a very object-oriented with prototype. Anyway, sorry, I should stop talking about, okay. So we create a few things. And then we have this function. All right, we give it some names. And then we're going to use these for things. So we're saying we got sort of two GL contexts we're going to make. A GL context is basically you're saying, within this website, I want some region to use WebGL. So GL context tells the JavaScript what part of the page is using WebGL. And then here, I come along here, I get the context that's being used, I grab that part out of the page, unless I fail, because, you know, I might fail. Quite often, actually. And if I got it, then I try to match the context to the object it belongs to. This is a complicated and painfully important piece of it. So, I have a website, okay? I have some text here, and then I have my box that I want to draw, well, in this case, I want to draw my cyan rectangle in. Or triangle, I think it's just a triangle. Anyway, so this thing, the box on the page is called a canvas. And then over here in my JavaScript, we call it a context. And at some point in the history of the page, a context is created from the canvas. But as having been on websites, you will realize I can resize pages. I can zoom in and zoom out. And so the canvas might not be the same shape as the context I created for it. And so one of the things we're doing here is we're saying, if you found a context, make it the same size as the thing it's supposed to draw in. Because we have to say this. All right, if we can't, we say, we failed, okay? And so we give it back. So all this does is just says, make something that can draw. It already takes more lines than you wish, right? Okay, then we have this delightful function. Load shader from DOM. DOM stands for the document object model, which is basically a way of finding out other parts of the HTML document, looking inside other braces. So, we start by grabbing the particular thing that had the code. That will be one of these two script tags. So we're going to grab one of those objects, okay? And if we failed to find it, we're going to fail. And then we're going to say, here's our source, okay? So there's this tree-like structure of HTML. We grab text. This is basically a complicated way of saying find the text that was in the script tag. You don't have to worry a whole lot about it. It just grabs the text. So all of these lines here, the whole thing, just finds the text of the script tag. Having found it, we then need to tell the GL library to create a shader. What kind of shader? We have to tell it what kind we want. So this is where we're starting to hook up into a place where we can have code. Then we say, here is the source code. Compile it. Now, let's just pause for a minute and think about what could go wrong if we have one program compiling another program. What is a bad part of this, potentially? Yeah?
Error, if you get an error back from it.
Yeah, where does it go?
Well, here you're not like catching it or checking its valid.
That's because it doesn't throw. It's not an exception.
Did it return a return status or?
Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah.
Does it do the usual JavaScript thing and just do nothing and then everything's broken?
Yeah, it silently sends some subset of error messages to the console, which most people don't ever look at. Okay, but it does send some error messages somewhere, just quietly, without telling you. Okay, and it can actually fail on either of these. It could be the source code doesn't look like shader source, or the compiling can fail. But if those both work, then we have to find out if it worked by getting the shader parameter of compile status, because it doesn't return, it doesn't throw, so we have to ask it, did you succeed? And if it does, then we're going to alert, we're going to show a pop-up window instead of just making it silent. So this tries to be a little bit nicer than otherwise. Otherwise, we're going to return the shader object. So this just compiles a shader and returns it. Okay? This is object-oriented in the worst possible way. Okay? The shader is an object that contains the compiled code. But because we have a namespacing problem in Java, we have a separate object that contains the function that works on the object. So this is the thing that matters, and it should be shader.compile shader source. That would be the right way of writing it in OO, but we can't do it because JavaScript. All right, so we end up with a compiled thing inside this object. So that's what that function does. This function then loads both shaders, calls that thing that compiles, and then, okay. So Let's talk briefly about why we have programs and attaching and linking. All right, let's think about this pipeline again, because you know I keep coming back to this picture. Okay, this whole set of things here will draw a scene. Okay? But in general, as we're going along, we want to have multiple of these whole pieces that we can run at different times, right? Even for a single scene, we might want different ones. Because if we think about this, it's unlikely we want the same fragment shader for the water as we do for the object behind the water. And so it is common to actually want multiple of these things. So we are going to call this whole thing, well, I should say this whole thing, we're going to call this a program, okay? Which contains multiple shaders, which is a reason we don't call them programs, okay? They're also more than functions, because one shader can have multiple functions, so sort of like modules, maybe? Anyway, so what we do here, we've compiled the two shaders, we create a program, we attach the two shaders to it, and we link it. Okay? Just like you would on the command line, except usually you don't realize it's doing it because Clang does it all, right? And then you say, did it work? Because it might not have. Because maybe one of these wanted an input, the other one didn't provide us an output or the like. They might not link up correctly. Okay? And if it all worked, then we have this one extra piece. Okay? Remember, back up here, way back up here, we had a vertex position. That had to come in somehow, and there's actually multiple steps of hooking it up. So down here, oh, not set up buffers yet. Down here, after we compile it, and we say it's the one that's currently being used, because we have multiple programs, we can swap them out. We also say, I want to know what was the location in memory, or pseudo memory, where I needed to write data for it to show up as a vertex position in the shader program. Find that location and save it somewhere I can find it later, because I'm going to need to put data there and I have to know where it was. Okay? So this is essentially telling me where is this arrow. I need that arrow because I have to shove stuff in the top of it. And this line right here, 103, finds the arrow for me. Okay, that's set up. Now we do other things. We make three triangle vertices by making a buffer that is allowed to store points. And it's an array buffer because it's an array. And here is its contents. And since this is a JavaScript array that's sitting on the CPU, I need to manually say, okay, I want the buffer data that's an array buffer to be made from those, turned into floats with these static draw rules. This is not going to change in the middle of drawing. Okay, and there's other ways we could do this. It has three things and they're each three elements long. So it's just a way of saying, here is, this is essentially our XYZ commands in homework 2. Okay? And then we have draw. Draw says, set up your viewport transformation. Hopefully this is starting to look vaguely familiar. Clear the screen with some background color. Here is the place where I want to put data. The list of things in the data, how many of them there are, what kind of thing they are, and then a few extras about ways they can be used. So there's extra flags there that I'm not going to spend the time diving into right now. So here is where you find the data, and then I want us to use it, and then I want us to draw. Okay? So here it is located in memory, shove it down to the graphics card, draw it. And then the startup is going to be run when the document is loaded, and it says, okay, find where we're allowed to draw, create the context, give us some debug wrapper around it so we'll get some kind of error message somewhere, make the shaders, make the buffers, clear, say the background is black, and then call draw, okay? And then the part that you can see is just this. Here's the body of the document. It contains a canvas that's this big. Ta-da! And this is the smallest WebGL example I could find. So, what do we think?
Yeah,
Yeah.
Can we see it?
Oh, sure, yeah. That's a great idea. Let's do that. Let's figure out how we would do that first. I probably shouldn't do it this way, but I will because, you know, I'm feeling lazy. All right, so let's go down to some arbitrary file. Oh, let me make this a little bit bigger so it's easier for you to see. All right, so I'm going to paste that, save that, close that, open it. This is going to be really exciting. You're going to be so glad you waited for this. Uh-oh.
I think it's trying to import the...
Oh, yeah, I don't have the web debug utils. All right. You're going to be so glad you waited for this. I was so right. All right. Let's actually just see. Let's go in here and let's just comment that part out. Because, you know, I don't really need to see debugging information. Somebody else wrote this code. But that means I also don't have the debug information. Where was the debug information used down here? Let's just get rid of the debug context so that I don't get debugging. And let's hope that works. The most applause I've ever gotten for being boring talking about somebody else's code. All right. And then we have it, you can then say, okay, how can we modify it and make it do something interesting? And that's where all of the stuff that happens on top of this happens. Okay, before we dive into that, thoughts, comments, questions, things you would like me to describe. Yes?
Okay, so when you attach the shaders to the program,
yep.
How did they know where in the pipeline to attach themselves?
Yeah, how did they know where to attach? That actually happened here.
Okay.
Yes?
It seems like a lot of this stuff is just like...
boilerplate?
We wouldn't have to change it, yeah. We would just have to change like, the stuff and whatever the one function that you did where you actually had the points and stuff like that.
Yeah, except, let's suppose, oh, I don't know, we wanted to add a light. Where does it go? Right? I need, at a minimum, to either have it changing even just color. Right? Even if I just want like the red, green, blue triangle that was the demo of homework two, or homework one, rather. That means that I needed to somehow get a color from here to here, which means I needed to get into here, which means when I specified the points, it wasn't enough to give the location, which means I have to look up how I would treat the other information. So yes, you're right, there's not a whole lot that has to change, but there's more than you probably wished. Yes, we'll actually show some examples of this, but yeah.
If you have multiple shader programs for the same shader, like multiple fragment shaders, is it not like allowed to have multiple main functions? Or
any given source needs to not have multiple functions with the same name. Just like programs, right? Every program you run has a main function. It just has one, but every one has its own.
So like for all the fragment shaders, they can only be one.
For all the fragment shaders in a given program,
yeah.
Which is only one fragment shader.
Yeah. Okay.
Right? So when I think about the pipeline, I can't have more than one of these because I wouldn't know where to send data. Mm-hmm. So I can have one of each of these in any given program. Other questions? Yeah.
But you could use a different fragment shader for every buffer for your vertex.
Yep.
By
swapping out the programs. Yep. Theoretically, I could take the existing program and recompile it with a different shader, but that's inefficient. So what we'll typically use, we'll make a separate program for every combination of shaders I might want, and send in the data for one at a time. Notably also, and we sort of glossed over this because you were all kind of tired by the time I got there. But let's look at this line right here. Here I am clearing. I can clear the color buffer, I can clear the depth buffer, I can clear the alpha buffer, I can clear different buffers. If I don't clear, load a new program and draw more stuff, it goes in the same scene. If I do clear, it goes in a new one. Right? So this allows me to change programs within a single picture, for a single frame of that picture. And so it's fairly common if I want some sort of animation with multiple different kinds of things going on, then I might have draw, clear, load a program, draw some stuff, load a different program, draw some stuff, load a different program, draw some stuff, load a different program, draw some stuff. And all of that will be combined. And because I haven't cleared anything, down here in the color, in the frame buffer and color blending part, our depth buffer will come in there, and they'll all look like they're part of the same scene. They're rendered with different programs, but each of them just generates fragments with depth components, and the color blending will merge them all together, and you won't be able to tell. Okay? So we have a great deal of flexibility with this model once you start to think in it. Yes?
So a lot of the times I've heard that you can sort of look at OpenGL as like a state machine.
Yep.
In the sense that like you have a bunch of like state setting functions and state using functions.
Yep, absolutely.
So I was wondering if you could sort of go through like a couple of those.
Yeah. So a lot of that is said about earlier versions of OpenGL. So WebGL is based on OpenGL 2.0 ES, although I think they've upped to 3.0 ES in some browsers now. Anyway, so what is the state? Okay, we think about CPU, GPU. Part of what OpenGL in particular is trying to do is hide this difference. I don't want to think about when I am sending data to my graphics card, in part because what if it doesn't have room? So OpenGL is going to try to sort of abstract this. And so while this is the state that's really happening, and this is the communication that's costing us time and matters a lot, OpenGL is going to give us instead this idea of the OpenGL state. It technically has client state and server state, which is sort of like these two, with some memory management added on top. But I have OpenGL and JavaScript is sort of the other one, okay? So I think about what did the JavaScript slash the HTML JavaScript here know about. It had, in its state, it had, for example, source code. It had GLSL source code for the two shaders, for the fragment shader and for the vertex shader. Okay? OpenGL didn't know about this state yet. So what we were needing to do is we needed to go tell OpenGL that I want a program. And current OpenGL ES doesn't have one global state. It sort of sends you back a state set. The program acts like a group of states. Okay? There's a separate kind of group of states about data. Okay? So it brings this back. It gives me this program here. And then I'm going to change this state. So I'm going to send it a fragment shader. I'm going to compile that. I'm going to send it a vertex shader. I'm going to compile that. That's modifying the state of that program, okay? And then I'm going to ask it for where do I put in my attributes to make my pixels? And so that gives me a copy of a piece of its state that's located because of this other state, okay? So old OpenGL was very state machine-like. This is less so. It's more object-like in many ways. And so then once I have this, the other piece that this has is it has sort of the active program. Okay? And so I'm going to send it my program, really just an identifier of it because it's storing the program on the chip. But I'm going to say, this is the program I want to do, and here is my vertices. Okay? And that all gets loaded into graphics memory and nothing more. And then I say, draw. And then it draws. Okay? And I can keep saying draw until I send new vertices, it has those vertices in state. Until I send a new program, it has that program in state. Okay? So I can send what the active program is, what the active vertices are, and change those things around. Does this help? So old OpenGL, OpenGL 1, had a stack of matrices and all this sort of internal state that has been removed in later editions because they were useful, but they prevented you from doing things people really wanted to do. Other questions? Yes?
So that demo you had at the beginning of class, you're like clicking your mouse.
Yeah.
So like JavaScript gets the mouse click, but like how does that?
Right, so HTML generates the mouse, it goes into JavaScript, and yeah, so shall we try going back there and seeing what it goes? Because this is all JavaScript, we should be able to find the source, right? Oh, no, we don't want that one. because that's all things that Chrome does that's not supposed to be part of GL. All right, so let's just look at this. Here it is. Let's go view the demo. I'm going to crash down the video again because, you know, I can't help it. Let's look at the source and close this. All right, so here is the source of this page. And I'll notice right away, it's opening a lot of other JavaScript files. Okay? And it has a bunch of its CSS, which makes the background and so on. And it doesn't actually have any of the source code here except Google Analytics. Okay. So I need to guess which one I think. So let's start with main. How about main? Here is main. It turns text to HTML. It has error mapping code. It has stuff about sphere physics. It has its on load. What do you do when you resize? All kinds of stuff it's trying to do there. I see the GL clear color. I see a little bit going on here. I also see there's matrix modes thrown in here. Okay. So it's using some older GL that has matrices right there. This GL is not built into GL. This is a library they imported to have a JavaScript parallel of GL matrices and vectors. But notice here, it says we have this object called water where they're adding a random drop. And then somewhere, that means that probably is what had the flash. So let's go look at water. I should comment, this is the first time I've seen any of this, so it's a reasonable chance I'll say something false. But here I see an opening string with escaped new lines. So this is a string. So they decided to put the shader source in a string instead of a tag. Okay, so this is the vertex shader source for water, where I don't see a whole lot going on here, except that I'm multiplying by 1/2 and adding 1/2. So we're sort of shifting to sort of a pseudo new vertex thing here. Okay. But then we get a plane, and that probably generates a buffer that we can use to draw things. We could go look at GL mesh and find out. And then we have all of this stuff about how we set up our mipmap for our textures. Because we have textures, we need to say how they're mapped into things. And here is our shader source. Okay. So our uniform, I should mention this. Let's go back here. I mentioned the name of two of the kinds of data that comes in. So we had our attribute, and we had our varying. These ones that come in from the sides, these are called uniforms because they don't change. They are always the same for everybody. So three basic kinds of input. So we see that this has some uniform information about where the water is, okay? But then also has a varying where it is located because the vertex shader could have moved it. And then it does looks up a texture and draws stuff and so on. We have the update shader. So apparently the shader will change. And we could spend some time trying to figure out what's going on here, but just glancing down here, it appears that we're moving vertices. So the vertex shader is moving things for us. So that's apparently the ripples are happening in the vertex shader, evidently. We have a normal shader. It's changing the surface normals. We have a sphere shader. Was there a sphere in the water?
Yeah.
Okay. So we have a way of drawing the sphere. Here we have add drop. And what does this do? This draws into the texture. So it's actually modifying the contents of the texture, which is then being used by the vertex shader to create the ripples. So it looks like all of this is actually modifying an image, the texture, to create things working. And we can keep going, okay? And then they have the step simulation, which modifies things and so on. And then we haven't looked at most of these yet, right? So this is designed to be a fancy example. It does quite a bit more. Yes?
Is there like a benefit to having the OpenGL code in the HTML script tag versus in the JavaScript?
Not particularly. It will syntax highlight it for you in most editors, but that's about it. Other questions? All right, we're just about out of time today. When we come back on Thursday, we're probably going to teach Twiggle, which will make some of this a little easier, and then do some real examples and see what happens. I will see you all on Thursday.